Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, September 28th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Steve.
And also with us in the studio, WCAI reporter Sarah Tan. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
Joining us later will be Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now, a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the islands. Last night in Wellfleet, it was a community forum on dealing with sharks along our coast. This was in response to the shark bite death of Arthur Medici off Wellfleet on September 15th. Sarah Tan, you were there last night. Give us a sense of it. What was the turnout and who was represented?
Sure. Yeah, it was a packed meeting at the Wellfleet Elementary Gymnasium, standing room only, with a polite but tense kind of feeling in the room. There was public comment that went essentially for 2.5 hours with people speaking to town officials. A lot of people seemed very angry. They felt like the town was not doing enough. There were a lot of people who called for culling of the seals or the sharks or both populations. And there was a lot of argument over how much responsibility the town has to put in protections to protect people from swimming on their beaches.
What are some of the ideas that we've heard, Kristen, from people about how we can protect the beaches and protect swimmers at the beaches?
So as Sarah mentioned, some people brought up the idea of culling or opening up fishing of sharks. Environmentalists who were there said, you know, that white sharks and seals are part of the ecosystem. They contribute to a healthy environment. And also a representative from the Department of Marine Fisheries said that changing those laws that protect sharks and seals would be a really complicated process. Others really urged more technical solutions, like use of drones to better patrol the water and get eyes on sharks, and improved communications. People were really upset sort of that a lack of cell phone coverage there hasn't been rectified, that there's limited communications from the beach to get rescue crews there as soon as possible. Some have said that legislators and the governor's office have offered money to help fix the solution, and that the town is also working on a plan that could involve call boxes and would hopefully be in place by next summer.
Sarah, there were even some sort of more farther out technical ideas that were floated there. One of them mentioned was armbands that make noises when people go into the water. Is that right?
Yeah. Someone actually mentioned armbands that would emit an ultrasonic noise that could possibly deter sharks. He said if everyone in the water was wearing an armband, it would create like a sound barrier for the sharks. It's not a noise that you would necessarily hear, but it's one in the water and that would confuse sharks. And I guess there's a thought that sharks would be like, okay, I don't want to go over there. So that's kind of an interesting one. And then someone else mentioned marine patrols, which is something that's in place in Southern California to protect surfers from sharks. You know, patrols that see a shark way out, come back in, and will bring everyone off the beach and say, can't be in the water right now. Everyone get back on the beach. There's a shark out there.
And I guess drone surveillance is one thing that we've heard a lot about. And there's real questions about how much it would cost, how much of the beach it could really protect, and how effective that would be.
Yeah, definitely some concern about how I think Dan Hort mentioned that it was very expensive to get drones.
Dan Hort from the town of Wellfleet.
Yes, the Wellfleet town administrator.
I think communications on the outer beaches has been a big question. You were mentioning this earlier, Kristen. There's just on a lot of those outer Cape beaches, there's little or no cell service. And the town really is seeing this and identifying this as an issue.
Yeah, they've said they are working on that. Was definitely a solid thing that came out of this meeting. They absolutely were going to work on improving communication in whatever way they could.
How about concerns about economic impact? Was that brought up at any point during the meeting? Did you hear something about what it could mean for the economy of the Cape having this?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of people really did mention, they pointed out how much media presence there was at the meeting, and there was quite a lot. And they mentioned that there were a lot of eyes on the Cape right now watching this meeting, and a lot of them said that they were really concerned about what people who live in Florida or New York or even in Boston are going to be thinking of what their vacation beaches, you know, it's a shift in mindset that's happening right now, I think. Mm.
It sounds like the seals question is one of the big emotional questions here. A lot of people feel like the seals are to blame for bringing in the white sharks, and a lot of equally a lot of people feel like it's an ocean environment. The seals and the sharks belong there, and it's up to us to adapt. Was that a sense of what it felt like in the room? This kind of two, almost, I don't want to say competing camps, but two visions of how this works.
Definitely, yeah. There was definitely a group of people who acknowledged that they have changed the way that they interact in the water, the way that they bring their families in the water, and the precautions that they take. And then there was a group of people who felt like they did all those things that everyone told them to do, not go swimming at dawn or dusk, and, you know, not try to look like a seal and not be in the valleys between sandbars. And they felt like Medici was doing all these things and he still got killed. Mm. So a lot of people feel like there has to be something that can be done by the town. And then there are a lot of people who feel like there's just a changing environment and we've got to adapt.
There was even an emotional testament from somebody who felt who was expressing the sense that a lot of people felt this was coming. And you could see this coming, and that to have it happen almost represented a negligence on the part of a collective negligence, that we knew this was coming and somehow we were unable to stop it.
Yeah, there was a lady who was actually there at Newcomb Hollow and who assisted with the rescue effort of Medici when that happened. And, you know, she saw the man, and she said that this was something that everyone knew was going to happen, and we all just hoped it wasn't going to be our child or our friend. And now it's happened, and she felt like the town was still taking the same approach.
Mm. Let me ask you one other thing about Representative Sarah Peake was there. And did they talk a little bit about what the response is, maybe on a state level, or is there anything that the state can do?
She didn't mention any pending legislation, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah.
No pending legislation. She essentially said that state officials were ready to provide extra funding and monetary support if needed.
Okay, Sarah Tan, thank you for that. And actually, stick around because we're going to speak now about the herring issue, which is another big story this week. The decision to protect herring in coastal waters coming out, and a lot of local fishermen felt like this was a long time coming. It was a big deal.
Yeah. The herring decision was earlier this week. It established a 12-mile buffer zone in between the coast that would extend from Maine down to about the tip of Long Island. It's a big decision to protect herring. And a lot of local fishermen, yeah, they've been, for Cape fishermen, this has been a fight that's been ongoing for about 15 years, is what I've told.
Kristen, what are some of the issues that Cape fishermen have been pointing to here about why we need these kinds of protections inshore?
Well, what Cape fishermen, and actually fishermen all along the East Coast, have argued is that the massive nets and large vessels that are used to catch herring, used by the midwater trawl herring fleet, are really so good at what they do that they're catching so many herring that the species that eat herring don't come close enough to shore for the smaller vessels to be able to fish. Our reporter who covered this story talked to one Chatham fisherman who said he has to go to George's Bank sometimes in a 35-foot boat just because there are no fish inshore for him to catch, and that really that this is a long overdue buffer. They were actually considering options that could have extended the fishing ban as much as 50 miles offshore, but I guess even this 12-mile limit was expected to slash the income of the trawler fleet by as much as 35%. They say that 75% of recent catches are coming from within that ban area.
Sarah Tan, you spoke with a fisherman this week. What was your sense of their, it was a local fisherman, their reaction to the decision?
Yeah, he was a Chatham ground fisherman, and he said that he would have preferred more. I think a lot of fishermen,
a bigger buffers.
Yeah, they were hoping for either 25 or 50 miles. The council did vote for the lowest buffer zone, which is 12 miles year-round. But he said he's been fighting for these regulations for over a decade, and basically since midwater trawlers, they pick up all the herring that the fish that ground fishermen or striped bass fishermen fish. Herring are a prey fish and
a forage fish.
Forage fish, excuse me. Still learning the terminology a little bit. But essentially because the herring are all getting picked up, all the larger fish that eat those herring are getting pushed out further offshore, which makes them inaccessible to these small boat fishermen.
And also, I think we heard talk this week about the impact it has on recreational fishing, as well as a lot of those inshore fish. If the forage fish aren't there at the bottom of the food chain, then the whole food chain going up has a harder time. And again, Kristen, you were mentioning the impact it could have on midwater trawlers. And these folks were saying that they are already feeling squeezed.
That's right. The year-round ban, some of them are saying, is that it will kill the winter fishery for them. They said that ocean warming has made it more difficult to catch herring during the summer, and that those herring trawlers have become more reliant on the winter fishery when herring congregate in larger schools.
Yeah, and I guess I spoke with a fisheries liaison for a large midwater trawl fleet in Rhode Island. She mentioned to me that the industry is already feeling pressure from the incoming offshore wind industry. She mentioned that wherever a wind farm pops up, midwater trawlers are not going to be able to fish, and the 12-mile buffer zone will create yet another place where they're not going to be allowed.
And I noticed in Doug Fraser's article in the Cape Cod Times, the midwater trawler folks were also talking about climate change and how warming waters have really pushed out a lot of the herring as well. They're fighting against that. And so now here's one more limitation that they have to try to fish within and still try to make a living. Mm-hmm. We're going to speak right now with Bill Evel at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Bill?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
Bill, the Martha's Vineyard Commission has received a big grant to fight nitrogen in Lagoon Pond. It's a big deal toward restoring the health of the pond. And the solution, what they're planning to do, is pretty cool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the commission received a $250,000 federal grant as part of the Restore America's Estuaries project to reduce the groundwater pollution in Lagoon Pond. Now, Lagoon Pond, when you come in on the Vineyard Haven Ferry, it's off to the left beyond the drawbridge. And it's really one of the most critically endangered ponds on the island, and this is because of due to excessive nitrogen, and that's a result of the runoff from the development around ponds, from the septic tanks and also from fertilizer, and basically nitrogen kills the pond. It stars the oxygen and the eelgrass and the shellfish, just about everything dies. So this grant is part of a pilot project, and it was The pond borders both Oak Bluffs and Tisbury, so both towns were involved, and everybody got together to help with this grant. And the project is really cool. It basically creates a wood chip barrier between the homes and the water, so it stops the nitrogen before it even gets to the water. Now, the grant, $250,000, is the largest grant that the commission ever received, but, of course, that's not a ton of money, and it really will, for this pilot program, is just going to be 200 feet of a barrier. So it really is just testing it out. And then hopefully as it works, they will get more money and they can do it for more of the ponds. It's definitely worked in other areas, but this is the first time we're going to be doing it here.
Now, the nitrogen problem is not just located in Lagoon Pond. It's fairly widespread.
Exactly. So, I mean, there's a lot of different things that are going to it. You know, shellfish itself works because they eat and filter the nitrogen. But a lot of this stuff is sort of dealing with it already in the pond. This now can stop it from going, you know, before it gets there. For ponds, for anywhere, really, where development, you know, leads right into this runoff into the pond. So it's really exciting. The thing, Adam Turner of the commission, he said the trick is now for the pilot program is finding out where to put it. And that's what they're really going to be studying because they want to make sure it gets in the right place. It has to be directly perpendicular and it's underground. So making sure it is effective so that then they can prove it is working. It has worked in other places, so they say the technique does work, but you want to make sure you figure out the exact spot around Lagoon Pond, and that's what they're studying now so they can put this into effect and, you know, help for the future.
What kind of timetable are they looking at?
18 months. Yeah, so 18 months to figure out where to put it, to then install it, and then to start to see how it develops. The wood chips themselves, they say they last for 30 years. So once it's in, it can really just keep going. So that's the exciting part, too, that it's not something you have to keep adjusting. But we'll sort of be following the story over the next 18 months, and it'd be exciting to find out when they choose the spot and how that'll work. It'll be on town land where around the lagoon.
Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette. Bill, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve. Have a good week.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. And on the phone with us right now is Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, the Chatham Select Board voted to create a task force to identify ways to help the town retain young families. This is a big issue to tackle.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not just a Chatham issue, of course. Cape communities are all wrestling with this problem of how to attract and retain young families. This week, the Board of Selectmen took that initial step to actually do something about the issue by they voted, as you said, to establish a task force. And what they're going to do is investigate, look into the town's demographics and economic imbalances, and ultimately find a way to ease some of those burdens that seem to be keeping young families, young working families, away. And, you know, during the discussion this week, some interesting statistics came up, including the fact that 51% of Chatham residents report income from trust funds and investments and other non-wages, as compared to a statewide average of only 22%. And the number of deaths in town far outpaced the number of births. With there last year, there were 25 births and 175 deaths registered in town. And that's a trend we've seen that's been going on for over many, many years, and it seems to be diverging more and more. And of course, the much discussed high cost of living in town is one of the major factors in young families finding it difficult to live here year round. And other factors that have come up include the school department, the school system. There's been talk about realigning grades in the Monomoy Elementary School system. And people say if you start talking about doing away with, a local elementary school, that's going to keep young families away. Mm-hmm. And Selectman Shireen Davis said she was a little critical of the town, said that they focused a lot on building the municipal infrastructure and sort of preserving community character through historical restrictions and things like that, that they seem to have not focused as much on issues that are really at the core of keeping the community diverse and together, you know, having young people in the schools, having young workers to take care of some of the support and service jobs in town. She suggested hiring a facilitator to work with the task force and town committees and staff and residents and sort of moving beyond rhetoric was her quote there. And now the town has an economic development committee, which has actually been looking at some of these issues. And Chairman Luther Bates told the selectmen that they've made several recommendations that have been sort of either ignored or rejected by officials in town. One was to have a policy to consider the impact that increases in municipal fees, like disposal area fees or beach fees, might have on young families. And another recommendation they made was to consider subsidizing the very expensive cost of childcare. Bates said everybody loved that idea, but then nothing happened with it. So those ideas will also, I expect, feed into this task force in their deliberations. And so Selectman asked Shireen Davis and board member Peter Kukulis to work on the details of what would compose a task force, and as well as a path towards something like a strategic planning session to begin developing some sort of concrete actions that that the town could take in this area. And they will return to the board with a report on October 22nd.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
With me in the studio is Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, the state this week released the scores from standardized testing at the schools. These tests are called the MCAS, and now there's a new generation of these tests. What did the state have to say about how the schools are doing?
So it really looks like these results were kind of a mixed bag. Results from the legacy MCAS, which tests 10th graders, showed the overwhelming majority of those test takers had no problem meeting state standards for high school graduation. But results from this, what's now the second year of the next generation MCAS, showed that students in grades 3 through 8 really struggled to meet or exceed expectations in English language arts and in math. Just about half of those students either met or exceeded expectations on the English language arts test. The exception there was in grade 7, where only about 46% of students met those standards. And less than half of 4th through 8th graders met those standards in the math side of the test. About 50% of 3rd graders did meet the expectations in math. And on the Cape, it seemed like that we saw similar results here, that next generation results for the top two scoring categories, which is meeting or exceeding expectations, hovered right around the 40% to 50% range. Some schools on the Cape did better than others. The West Villages School in Marston's Mills, for example, showed that grade 3 scores improved in both English language arts and in math. 71% and 72% of students met those top two categories there. But at East Falmouth Elementary School, third grader scores declined. Only 29% there met or exceeded expectations in math. Similarly, at Centerville Elementary and Barnstable Community Horace Mann Charter Public School in Hyannis, they exceeded state averages there, but fewer than 40% of students in the middle grades at various Barnstable schools met or exceeded those expectations.
It sounded like the older grades, 10th grade, were taking the legacy MCAS, and the results were stronger for the schools.
Yeah, at the high school level, it seemed like things turned out much better. Then they seemed, again, to be sort of in line with what the overall results were from the state. The percentage of students who finished in the top two categories in English ranged from 91% at Monomoy to 100% actually at Sturgis and at Nauset. Results in math were a little bit lower. It looked like about 81% hit those top two categories in the Upper Cape Technical Schools, and 97% at Sturgis. Science scores dipped a little bit from there. The Cape's two technical high schools hit about 72% of students meeting those categories, and 93%, I think, was the highest percentage of students that met the categories, and those were at Sturgis.
And the next generation MCAS, they call them next gen, these tests are considered to be a little bit harder than the legacy MCAS tests that students have been taking.
Well, that's right. So the next generation MCAS was the Department of Education's response to complaints about a national park assessment, which was the replacement for the MCAS. In 2015, they created this Massachusetts specific test. And some of the schools said, you know, that this has been a much harder test, that they've put in a lot of work and drilling to sort of prepare students for this test, and you know that may be why they're seeing some of the results that they are.
The National Seashore is getting an almost $10 million fix-up, and there are a lot of projects on the to-do list.
Yes, there'll be a rollout of $9.7 million in capital projects that Seashore Superintendent Brian Carlstrom says will help make a dent in a lot of deferred maintenance that's been going on at the Seashore. Others locally, Select Board Chairman from Provincetown, said it will also help protect public property from rising sea levels and the increasing number of storms that we're having here. The biggest project that's being planned is a $3.3 million construction of a 208-space parking lot north of Herring Cove Beach. Now, there's a parking lot that's twice as big on the southern end of the beach, and that's protected by dunes. But this drive-up and park lot people prefer has been battered in the last decade to the point where there's only really a few spaces remaining. The new lot would be built further inland but would have similar views, and hopefully it will be ready by next summer.
What are some of the other projects that they're looking at here?
So there are additional projects in the northern end of the seashore as well. $2.2 million will be spent to upgrade the Head of the Meadow bike trail in North Truro. That will include improved parking at High Head and upgrades to a dirt road that leads to Coast Guard Beach. Another $1.2 million will be spent in Truro for structural and safety repairs to Highland Light. And that lighthouse will actually close on October 21st and will remain closed throughout next year while the repairs are being made. $200,000 will be spent to demolish four homes at the former North Truro Air Force, now known as the Highland Center. And that demolition is required because a pesticide was actually injected at the foundations of those homes for termite control back when the base was active.
And this money comes to the parks really through the efforts of a lot of efforts from the park staff themselves and from the Cape delegation.
That's right. So U.S. Representative William Keating co-sponsored a House bill that was introduced in July. It's called the Restore Our Parks and Public Lands Act, and that would dedicate about $6.5 billion to repairs to public lands infrastructures over a five-year period. 80% of that would be dedicated to the National Park Service. And this problem of deferred maintenance that the National Seashore is seeing is really sort of reflective of something that's happened across the country. Nearly $12 billion in repairs are estimated to be needed across more than 400 national park sites to fix crumbling roads, outdated water pipelines, and other things.
I want to ask you about a story that you did that appeared in today's paper. It's about the Yarmouth Police Department announcing a capital campaign for new and better training. They say they're going to raise the money themselves instead of waiting for state funds.
That's right. So the Yarmouth Police Foundation held a press conference yesterday in which they announced a capital campaign to build a $1.2 million training facility that will be named after slain Sergeant Sean Gannon. And Yarmouth Police Chief Frank Fredrickson spoke at the conference. And what he said was, you know, we've been asking for help for training and for funding these types of things for so long. We really can't wait anymore. We decided we need to come up with a creative way to take action on our own. And that's really what they're doing. Plans for the facility, which is really supposed to be a state-of-the-art facility, include a simulator in the basement of the police station, which is already currently underway. That's estimated to total about $62,000 and will help officers interact in different situations where they may have to make split-second decisions. Also included behind the police station, they're planning to build a $300,000 mock house, a $400,000 canine and police obstacle course, a $500,000 live round contained shooting range. So that will feature soundproofing and bulletproofing. That's the only place where live rounds will be fired, as well as an additional 23-space parking lot behind the station.
So this would be something. There's nothing comparable to it on the Cape right now.
That's right. One of the things I found interesting that Fredrickson said is that the committee that's responsible for all municipal police training across Massachusetts doesn't actually own any property. So they really rely on places like Otis Air Force Base or other places to allow them to rent their facilities or use their facilities to do police training. A lot of times now, Yarmouth police officers are having to drive up to 4 hours off Cape to use one of the two simulators that the state currently owns. There's really going to be nothing like this on Cape or even really regionally. What police have said is that once this facility is built, they'll open it up for use by state, federal, local agencies, and it will really serve as a resource not just for the town of Yarmouth, but for other law enforcement officers in the region.
Let's speak now with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning. How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing well. Casey, a special town meeting held in Wellfleet this week, a couple of big issues taken on there, including a large solar array and buying a piece of harborfront property. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so the town meeting was really busy. There were 300 people there, estimated, and they bought a house, a waterfront home, very dilapidated home, a three-bedroom, two-bath, right next to Mayo Beach, for the maximum asking price of $889,000. How do you say that when you just, and there was a close vote, 179-72. They needed a two-thirds majority, so it was actually just 11 votes over the two-thirds threshold. And what's a little surprising about this, I guess, is that the whole finance committee voted against the purchase, and the proponents said they didn't really have a particular use for it at this point. They threw a lot of other things out, but their basic argument was, we're buying this because we don't want to see what could happen to it.
Mm-hmm.
That Dan Hort and Nancy Civetta, the shellfish constable, and Dan Hort's the town administrator, talked about how great it would be for the town to have a stretch of continuously owned waterfront property, and they also talked about the possibility of it becoming a McMansion or something to that effect, I guess. Now, the finance committee said they voted against it unanimously because there was no specific use for it, and they also mentioned the fact that the town of Wellfleet has to have their harbor dredged for an estimated cost of $20 million. And then there's waste management concerns in the town. And also there's the Wellfleet portion of the reconstruction of Nauset Regional High School. So there are a lot of big expenses the town's facing. On the other hand, the former town administrator, Harry Turkanian, argued for buying this home because the town has such a great bond rating right now, AAA mm-hmm. bond rating, and it's waterfront property, so it could always be sold if there's no agreeable use.
Tell us briefly about the solar array that was in discussion there.
Yeah, also the solar array passed. There were three separate articles. This is actually going to bring in an estimated $60,000 a year in electricity savings, and it will give $11,000 yearly payments in lieu of taxes to the town by the company that's constructing it. So so that passed unanimously with very little discussion.
Casey Myers of the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Kristen Young with me from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, finances in Brewster have been a topic that we've talked about on and off for a number of months as the town has seen a number of issues there. Now an official is asking for a state review.
That's right. So the interim town administrator, Mark Forrest, wrote a letter on September 13th asking the Department of Revenue to review the town's finances. And as you mentioned, this has been an ongoing issue after several questionable accounting practices were detailed by a consultant. An auditing firm hired by the town uncovered bad accounting practices that included the use of more than one ledger to track expenses, overdrafting accounts, spending money without town meeting approval, and turning off control that give town officials warnings about the overspending. No money has been missing. The practices have created several problems, though, within municipal departments, and those all centered on the town's fiscal 2017 budget.
And so now the state, they're going to have a review of the finances from the state, or they're requesting it?
So they're requesting it, but they also did, Finance Committee member Harvey Pete Dahl proposed creating a new audit committee. And the Finance Committee approved his proposal, and it's now sitting with Town Council for review. It will also have to go before the Select Board to be placed on the December special town meeting warrant.
I want to mention a follow-up to this, which is that the Select Board in Brewster voted to offer an apology to a couple of former employees who were wrongly accused in some of these financial problems.
Yes, the Select Board has now officially apologized to Lisa Suve, who's the former town finance director, and Charles Sumner, the former town administrator. The pair was accused of being responsible for a $37 million discrepancy in the town's finances by their successors, and that claim was found to be false by the town's auditor. In April, during a public meeting, the now resigned town administrator, Michael Embry, and Irene Larrivee, who was the finance director who's now on administrative leave while the town investigates her accounting practices, talked about the town's fiscal 2017 audit results and alleged that Suve and Sumner were responsible for the discrepancy. Last week, the town's longtime auditor, Robert Brown, said there was no discrepancy. Suve and Sumner both retired around the same time before the 2017 audit and were replaced by Embry and Larrivee.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Kristen Young. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Kristen, the saga of the Falmouth wind turbines continues. There's two of them, Wind 1 and Wind 2, and it looks like Wind 1 is on its way to being dismantled, but not so fast for Wind 2.
That's right. Neither of the turbines have been operational since a judge ordered them never to spin again in June of 2017. And as you mentioned, plans are underway to dismantle Wind 1 and haul it off the site. But things are looking a little more complicated for Wind 2. One neighbor's recent attempt to have it removed has sort of not met with success. Barry Funfar, who is a Falmouth resident, filed a complaint with Building Commissioner Rod Palmer on June 25th, shortly after Wind 2 had been shut down for a year. In his complaint, Funfar said that the year-long inactivity constituted abandonment under Falmouth's wind energy bylaw, and that it triggered a requirement that the turbine should be dismantled and removed. On September 12th, the building commissioner responded to Funfar and said that the town had fulfilled the mandate of the judge who ordered the termites to be shut down, but that they didn't really have any plans in place to move it, and that the building commissioner said the Wind 2 really hasn't been abandoned by the town. He said, well, it's not presently operating. The town's performing periodic maintenance to preserve it for possible relocation in the future. The town manager has hired an engineering firm to evaluate other spots where Wind 2 could potentially operate in the future. And Palmer said he apologized for his long overdue reply to Funfar. He said the complaint had been misfiled in his office, which is what, you know, led the process to be so long drawn out. Funfar has since expressed frustrations with Palmer's reply. He wrote an email that said some neighbors have been complaining that the town's been dragging its feet, it's really making people afraid to put any money into their homes, not knowing sort of what the future of this could be, and that he described it as a cloud of animosity that continues to hang over us.
We're going to speak right now with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Brian.
Hey, how's it going?
Brian, the Steamship Authority has announced rate hikes. What are they proposing? Tell us.
Yeah, so last Tuesday, the Steamship Authority Board had its monthly meeting on Nantucket. And at that meeting, Gerald Murphy, who's the steamship treasurer and comptroller, said that the steamship is going to have rate hikes for starting next summer season. And they're looking to generate about $7 million in revenue through rate hikes with passenger, freight, and summer parking rates. So the regular auto on-season rates are going to increase about $11.15. And for on-season excursion rates, which are usually what Islanders have, they're usually a little cheaper, they're going to have about a $3 increase each way, so $6 round trip. The last time that the steamship had these kind of rate increases for regular auto rates, it was in January 2013, and for excursion rates, it was January 2015. The steamship's also looking to increase the summer parking rates on Saturdays and Sundays by $5.
On the website for this story, I saw plenty of comments from readers. As you might imagine, I don't think I saw one that was supportive. But I did see a lot of questioning about how the authority seems to be answerable to no governing body but itself as it makes these kinds of decisions about rate hikes.
Yeah, people are definitely not happy with the rate hikes. But if it's any consolation, the walk-on passenger rates will not increase.
Brian, also in Oak Bluffs, they're looking for a new town hall. Town meeting voters already gave the go-ahead, but it's not so simple. Give us an update here.
Sure. So at the last annual town meeting in April in Oak Bluffs, town voters approved $9.8 million for a new town hall. And after the first round of bids went out for construction of the town hall, they came in millions of dollars over budget. And so the building committee went back to the drawing board and cut out about $1.7 million in design aspects, such as getting rid of the basement, getting rid of a dormer on the second floor, and then sent it back out for a second round of bids. And those bids, again, came in way over budget. And so at their last meeting on Tuesday, the building committee chairman, Bill McGrath, presented the proposal asking town voters for another $1.3 million to meet these increasing bid costs. And selectmen were not happy with that, especially selectman Brian Packish, who was very critical of that because he felt that the asking the town for town voters for more money was essentially like promising them a black Range Rover with leather, moonroof, and navigation, and having to give them a Ford Ranger with two-wheel drive and no radio for an extra $1 million.
Where does it stand now?
So So, yesterday, Bill McGrath, the building committee chairman, was out front of the Oak Bluffs post office, and he was gathering signatures on a petition to get this article on the warrant. So McGrath presented the article to town selectmen, but he is having this petition filled out, and he needs at least 100 signatures, and he estimates that he already has that. And that will essentially ensure that the article will get on the warrant. And he said he was hoping that selectmen would approve this, but he was just doing this as kind of a fail-safe. And once again, Brian Packish was not happy with that, and he felt that it was inappropriate for McGrath to be doing that.
Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian, thanks for checking in with us.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good one.
Kristen Young with me from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, a new emergency dispatch center is helping to improve fire response time in Hyannis.
Yes, so there's been a lot of buzz around the Hyannis Fire Department moving into its new $18.5 million headquarters soon, but what a lot of people might not know is that the new dispatch system has actually been up and running for most of the summer. I guess mobile calls for fire and medical emergencies in the Hyannis Department, which is the Cape's largest village, are no longer answered 40 miles to the north in Middleborough.
I was surprised to learn that they were being answered all the way off Cape.
Yeah, it sounds like the process was a bit bumbling previously to get the calls to where they needed to be. They were previously transferred by cell towers to a Massachusetts State Police Dispatch Center in Middleborough. They were then forwarded to the Barnstable Police Department, which in turn would forward them to the Hyannis Fire Department. And then police would often return to the line after a fire apparatus was dispatched, meaning that callers could have to speak to up to four different people when reporting an emergency. And what the Barnstable Police Lieutenant Mark Cabral, who is the dispatch's oversees the dispatch center, said that was a big frustration for callers being bounced around when they're trying to get important information relayed quickly.
So the new system should allow them to respond even more quickly, one can imagine.
That's right. Our reporter who covered this described the new police dispatch center as resembling a high-tech war room. He said it had dozens of video screens displaying maps, real-time data and other applications, and it underwent a $150,000 remodel earlier this year. Now when a call for Hyannis Fire is received, the dispatcher enters critical data such as the location and nature of the call, and a newly installed software uses a female robotic voice to immediately broadcast directly to the fire station which apparatus and crews need to be activated. And while this is happening and crews are heading out to the call, the dispatcher at the police station remains online to assist the caller and gather more information for responders.
I want to move along and ask you about the town manager for Mashpee. He is heading to the nation's capital to push for a land bill for the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe.
Yes, Mashpee Town Manager Rodney Collins will be traveling to Capitol Hill to advocate for pending legislation that would end a legal challenge to the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe's reservation. Selectmen issued a statement on Tuesday expressing disappointment with the September 7th decision by the U.S. Department of the Interior that found the tribe was ineligible to have its 321 acres of land taken into trust. The board authorized Collins to meet with the town's legislative consultant and members of Congress to further advocate for the adoption of the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe Reformation Act. The legislation was introduced by Keating and by U.S. Senator Edward Markey in the House and the Senate.
It's fairly unusual for a town manager to be heading to Washington, but the whole energy around the Wampanoag tribal recognition right now is fairly fraught. Explain a little bit of that backstory about how this has come about.
Sure. So the Interior Department took 321 acres in Mashpee and Taunton into trust for the tribe in 2015, declaring it a sovereign reservation. And under that designation, the federal government holds the title to the property, but the tribe can decide on how to develop or use the land for its own benefit. The tribe's plans included a $1 billion casino in Taunton, but a lawsuit that was brought by neighbors of the proposed resort sort of threw everything into a legal limbo when a federal judge found that the Interior Secretary didn't have have the authority to take the land into trust the way that he had. The judge sent the decision back to the department for reconsideration, and it was reversed. The decision was reversed by a long-awaited September 7th determination by the Interior Department that said the tribe was not under federal jurisdiction at the time of the passage of the Indian Reorganization Act in 1934. An Interior spokeswoman has since said the agency will keep the land in trust pending the outcome of the overall legal case.
There are some new numbers out from federal fisheries regulators that suggest that just a few commercial fishing trips are being monitored, much below the required number.
Yes, so federal officials revealed Wednesday that most of the New England fishing cooperatives that catch cod, haddock, flounder, and other groundfish failed to meet the minimum standards for having observers on their boats. Those cooperatives are known as sectors. They're comprised of groups of fishermen who come up with their own fishing plan and enforcement measures to manage their shares of an overall quota. National Marine Fisheries Service Regional Administrator Michael Penteny sent letters to 14 of 19 sectors saying that they were below the required 15% of their trips accompanied by fish monitors and federal observers, and 10 of those sectors were even below 10%. What observers do is they count and identify the fish that are caught and discarded, which helps scientists estimate impacts on fish populations.
So this is they are really far below. What are some of the reasons why they're pointing? What are some of the reasons they're pointing to why the fisheries observers are at such low levels on these boats?
Well, and Penteny said that there were a number of issues across the region that resulted in low observer coverage. He said some of those include a shortage of trained observers and scheduling of trips on high-priority fisheries that leave others on lower-priority fisheries without coverage. But he also listed vessel infractions as a reason. Some of those included the refusal to carry an observer, not notifying NOAA of a fishing trip to avoid being assigned an observer, high rates of cancellations when trips were actually assigned an observer, and other tactics to avoid an observed trip.
And I guess there's a sense that the observers are critical for scientific data and also to keep the playing field level.
Yes, that's right. So environmental protectionists responded that this isn't fair to fishermen who need to have trust that the decisions they make on their fishing activity is based on good information. And they need to know that there's a level playing field, that everyone is playing by the rules and not just, you know, the people who are being more upfront about it.
I want to ask you about a story that your reporter Cindy McCormick did. It's kind of a fun story looking at the market for backyard pools on the Cape and whether they look more appealing now as a result of the concern of sharks.
Yeah, so it is interesting. People in the pool industry are reporting that a 30% increase in pool installations. Cindy, as you mentioned, talked with Shoreline Pools owner Chris Dietrich, who said that great white sharks are increasingly involved in the conversation when people are deciding to install a pool. He said that, you know, the increased number of sightings and now the two attacks, including the fatal one that happened 2 weeks ago, come up at almost every discussion that he has with his clients. Others are questioning whether it's really the shark effect or just the what's considered to be a strong economy that's driving the installation of pools.
If you want a pool, it sounds like a good excuse to move forward.
Sure. She did speak with others on Cape Cod too, who said that really this is just, we're seeing people spending more money all around, that pools are a luxury item, and that right now people have the money to put in a pool where they may not have had that a few years ago.
Kristen, you are a beat reporter for Yarmouth. I'm curious to ask you here at the end of the program if you can tell us a little bit about some of the other stories you're looking at in Yarmouth. I know that the issues around Lewis Bay have been a big question. We've talked about them on the roundup here, as the proposal to bring a power transmission cable through Lewis Bay has really ignited a lot of concern in the area.
Yeah, so Vineyard Wind, offshore energy company Vineyard Wind, that's planning a wind farm southwest of Martha's Vineyard, has identified a location in West Yarmouth as its preferred place to bring a cable onshore that would require routing the cable through Lewis Bay. And many Yarmouth residents, this has been in the news, have recently stepped up and really pushed back against this. Recently this week, two aquaculture grant holders who hold grants in Lewis Bay that total about 3.5 million oysters that they have at these grants were notified that they will be granted limited participant status in future siting board hearings by the Massachusetts Energy Facilities Siting Board Committee, which is the committee that will ultimately make the decision about where the cable comes on shore. I spoke with one of the shellfish fishermen yesterday. He said that the decision to be given limited participant status was actually a bit of a disappointment because, well, it does give them some feedback, opportunities to talk to people who will ultimately be making the decision and make their case. They won't be allowed to introduce new evidence. They'll only be able to comment when tentative decisions are made, and they won't have that sort of full, they won't be able to call witnesses or cross-examine witnesses, the things that they were really hoping to be able to do to really prove their case.
That is a roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you, Steve.
And thanks to all our other contributors. We heard from Sarah Tan, WCAI's reporter. We spoke with Bill Evel of the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.